Kia ora tanu. For those that don't know me, I'm Joe Hollander, Chair of the Far North North Defence Heritage Advisory Group and the Engineer Trust. And it's our pleasure to once again put on one of these monthly midday military history presentations for you. So we're absolutely delighted to have Cliff Simons. You'll see that on the invite poster. Cliff lives a few miles down the track from in Pye's Park, just down the road from Gate Park, and is very knowledgeable on the whole process, the history of the Tauranga campaign in 1864. For those that are directly interested in this particular period of our history and in this particular topic, if you want to have a look at the more detailed maps of some of the activities that Cliff's going to cover, you can actually pick these up on our engineer website, nzsappers.org.nz, where we've actually got the detailed maps from an 1869 report showing all of these battle sites and campaign areas. If anybody's interested in that, you can pick up the URL for the website on the brochures that we've left on the table there. Please put your hands together and welcome Dr. Cliff Simons.
Thank you, Joey, and good afternoon, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. There's a few faces that I'm pleased to see from the past. I live in Tauranga, and I have a lot to do with the local history. So what I'm going to do today is just talk about a campaign overview. I won't go into too much detail, but we'll look at the whole campaign from a fairly high level. So once the decision had been made to invade the Waikato, the British troops crossed the Mangata Ferry River in July 1863, and there was a bit of fighting behind the lines for a while, but basically there were a series of battles in fairly quick succession. So you can see Kohiroa, Meri Meri, and Rangiriri there, and by December 1863, the British troops had reached Narawahia, which is where the Maori king had his headquarters. There was a period of negotiations, but the war carried on into the upper, what was known in those days as the Upper Waikato. They went up the Waipa River rather than the Waikato, and as far as Te Rori, which was as far as you could navigate, either a canoe or a warship those days. Just remember that these warships that the British had were really steamships. They had a very short, they only needed a couple of feet of water. But at Te Rori there was a problem. General Cameron eventually got about 2,000 men to that point and a huge amount of stores, but the Kingitanga had built a tremendous fortification at that place you can see there, Patarangi. And it was really a defended barrier. It was a number of pass sites, and it was probably, it was almost like a brigade position. It could have been defended by 2,000 to 3,000 men. And General Cameron spent quite a lot of time looking at that position and decided to bypass it. And you can see that dotted line where he has bypassed it that leads on to Haerini, Rangiofia and Oraka. Now, while this was taken, so this is in January 1864. Now, if we go to the next slide, the circle shows where this is all taking place in Waikato. And you can see that Tauranga isn't all that far away. As the British had advanced into the Waikato, they had secured their flanks on both sides at the Kawhia Harbour and in the Firth of Thames, and the next logical place was going to be Tauranga Harbour. There was a system of shifts that the Maori were employing in defending at Patirangi, and they had sent emissaries out across into the Bay of Plenty, out into Tairawhiti, to try and encourage other tribes to send warriors to help defend at Patarangi. And they had certainly been in Tauranga, and they had been over on the east coast as well. And war parties were starting to converge into that area. Now, in Tauranga itself, the people in Tauranga were not necessarily adherents to the Kingitanga at this stage, but they were moving in that direction. Some had been in Taranaki in 1860 and 1861, but they had gone with Ngāti Hoa. You can see the iwi there by the Waikato River. That was a closely related iwi, and they had gone with some of their toa, or war parties, across to the Taranaki in 1860 and 1861. By 1863, more of the Tauranga people had become adherents to the Kingitanga, and some of them had been up at Mary Mary fighting and had fallen back as the British advanced, and they were now at Mangatauturi in the Waikato. Tauranga was known as the port of Waikato because it was known that men and material was coming in through there. For instance, gun runners. If you wanted to make some quick money, you could run a shipload of guns into the harbour and you could sell them, and they would find their way into the Waikato. Same with food. And also, that some of these war parties that were coming up from the east coast were being blocked. You can see that on the map, I can't point to it unfortunately, but you can see Te Arawa there on the Rotorua Lakes. Te Arawa had aligned themselves with the government, and they were blocking any of these parties going through their rohe. And so the way that you would normally do it is you would go up past Makatu, up to Tauranga, and then you would cross over the kaimais at that point. And the government was aware of that as well. So, for a lot of these reasons, General Cameron asked for a blockade to be put into the Tauranga Harbour. I was just indicating the movement. Now, in Tauranga itself, it was quite a heavily populated area. There were several thousand Māori. There were about 50 communities in and around the immediate part of the bay, where we might sort of say modern-day Tauranga and its and the suburbs that surround it. There were three iwi, Ngāti Rangi, Ngāti Ranganui, and Ngāti Pūkenga. And it was a thriving community. It's very fertile. It's a great climate. The fishing, of course, was tremendous. And they were supplying Auckland with food. And it was quite a thriving community. There's talk of 1,000 canoes being pulled up on one of the beaches in the harbour at one stage. The Pākehā population was small, probably about 50 people, and it was based around the mission station. So Archdeacon Alfred Brown had gone there in the late 1830s. He'd actually gone there earlier, but the musket wars were in play, and they had to abandon the place for a few years, and then they came back in the late 1830s. And the mission station was probably one of the more successful ones in New Zealand. It had purchased 1,330 acres of land, and there are stories of up to 500 Māori sitting examinations and things like that, but it was quite a successful mission station. And a large number of the Māori had been converted to Christianity to some degree by at the time of this war in the 1860s. Some of the wars that we've had around the country have been as a result of land. So I'm thinking of the Wellington situation or Taranaki. That wasn't the case in Tauranga. War came to Tauranga. It didn't generate out of the political situation that was there at the time. There was generally a cordial relationship between the mission, the Māori, and the few European traders that were there. So why did the troops come to Tauranga? Well, three warships sailed into the harbour on 21st of January, and the idea was to blockade the harbour to stop any men and material going across. The government had quite good intelligence. The missionaries and certainly one or two of the government agents had gone to Hui, where it was discussed that once the crops had been taken in, and taken across to Waikato, that a lot of the young men were going to go across and fight as well. And there was a fairly clear idea of what was going to happen. And another part of it was to stop warriors from Tauranga or those who were coming up the coast from going across the Kaimais and into the Waikato. And so a military camp was established at the mission station, and the mission station was known as Te Papa, so this became known as Camp Te Papa. Another reason was also that they wanted to occupy the Tauranga people with their own problems. And if they occupied them with their own problems, they wouldn't be available to go across and to fight in the Waikato. Now, the Maori response, they were horrified. They had been concerned ever since the Taranaki War that war could come to Tauranga, and they were very worried about it. Rawari Puhiraki, who became the military leader, was very reluctant to align himself too much with the kingitanga because he knew the risk of the troops coming. Not a large number had gone at this stage, but it seemed apparent to the government that was about to change. The civil commissioner was taken by surprise when the troops arrived, and he wrote a circular that was posted out to, or given out to, all of the different communities, telling them that this was nothing to worry about, and if the loyal tribes, the tribes that were in favour of the government or supportive of the government, were not at risk. It was only the rebels that were going to be in trouble. But of course, this was a problem. The military commander, who was Colonel Carey at the time, couldn't give the chiefs a clear answer as to why the troops had actually arrived, so there was quite a bit of confusion. So the fighters who were in the Waikato were called back, and some of the old traditional pā sites in the lower Kaimais on the edge of the forested area were strengthened. And Rawari Puhiraki developed this strategy of hoping to draw Colonel Greer. So Carey was replaced by Colonel Greer quite quickly, hoping to draw Colonel Greer out from Camp Te Papa into a battle up in the Kaimai somewhere where Greer would be at a disadvantage, where they could inflict significant casualties on the British, and they might also be able to attack Camp Te Papa at the same time. But Greer only had 600 men, and it would have been foolhardy to have undertaken that sort of thing. And he was also under instructions not to be aggressive. So this was a passive occupation that was taking place. Rawari had hundreds of young men, and they were expecting a fight. And through the months of February and March, they were preparing their power. They didn't know where the British were going to go. At one stage, they thought they might be going to land at Te Puna, which was thought to be deep enough water for the warships. And so Rawari tried to move things on a bit by sending letters to Colonel Greer, offering at one stage to build a road so that the troops could come up and not get too tired. So he's goading him, come on, what are you? Are you a man or not? He even set a date of the 1st of April. I don't think that was auspicious, but the 1st of April was the date that he set for a battle. Rules of engagement were devised and sent. And eventually, though, Greer just remained where he was, and Rawari moved to a closer pā at Potorifi pā on the Wairoa River. But the soldiers themselves, it was a relatively quiet and passive occupation through the months of February and March. And in early April, a large party of warriors from the east coast, or from Tairawhiti, tried to cross through the Rotorua area. And they'd asked permission, but they were refused. And they tried their luck, and they tried to push their way through. And so you can see the Rotorua Lakes again. So this war party tries to push through the Rotorua Lakes, and they are repelled. So in this Just in that area there, there was about a 3-day running battle where Te Arawa drove this East Coast war party back to the coast down near Matata and Makatu. Now, this war party was probably trying to get through to Patarangi or into that area, but they were driven back. Just to give you an indication that these two campaigns were going at the same time, the final battle at Orako, the final battle in the Waikato, was actually in late March and early April. And that was mainly warriors from the east coast. There was a large Tūhoe contingent there. So you can see that there were still warriors trying to move through the area at that time. That was a devastating battle. You probably know the story of a 3-day siege. And then about 160 Māori were killed as they tried to get across the Pūniu River into safety, into sanctuary, into what we now call the King Country, across the barrier into Ngāti Maniapoto Country. But back in Tauranga, what looked like a threat from the south had now been sealed off because that group had been driven back to the coast. Rauri now extended his strategy of trying to lure Greer into battle to the limit, and he moved to what's shown there on the screen as Gate Pā. The Māori word for that ridge is Pukihinahina. And he's on the 16th of April, during the night, they moved onto that position. Large number of men, women, and probably younger children as well, and they started to build a pub. And by morning, when the British soldiers shook themselves awake and looked through their telescopes up at the ridge at Gate Pā, they could see what they estimated to be up to 1,000 people there. It was probably an overestimation. But they were building a new pā. And there may have been some significance in this pā because it was on the border between the mission land and Māori-owned land. Now, Rauri and a lot of the others were Christian, and they may not have wanted to fight on the mission land. They may have actually, because the idea was that the missionaries, the Europeans, were entitled to be on their land, but they weren't entitled to be on the Māori land. That may be the case, we don't really know, but it was definitely the best location for a defensive pā anyway. It's a superb site. So they were building on Gate Pā, and Colonel Greer and his men held what they described as a council of war, and they decided that this indicated that Rauri was getting ready to attack them. And a message was sent to Auckland immediately to send more troops and more heavy artillery. And so there's confusion about the aims of both of these parties. Now, General Cameron had just finished the Waikato campaign. The Waikato campaign had been a trial of logistics, you know, going up those rivers. And a lot of it had been about logistics and supplies, hauling heavy guns up there. And now he hears that there is a large pā being built virtually on the coast, and there are a large number of defenders. And he thinks this is a great opportunity for a decisive battle. Some of the battles in Waikato had been, they were tainted with some of the things that had happened. Rangiofia, Orako, they had left a bad taste. And so here was a chance for a decisive political and military victory, and he took the opportunity. So, the week before the battle, things started to change drastically. First of all, General Cameron didn't just send troops, he arrived himself. And he came with enough extra men that there were now nearly 2,000 soldiers at Gate Pā. And this was really quite a significant force that had been put together. At the same time, that war party that had been trying to cross through Te Arawa country and had been driven back was reinforced by more warriors, and they were now 700 strong, and they launched an attack on a combined British and Te Arawa fortification in Makatu, in the town itself. and they were driven off. I'll just go to the next slide, and then I might have to come back. So this is the Pai Mare Pa, or Fort Stockade, in Makatu. And this Tairawhiti War Party attacked it. And they were driven off, and it was a combined operation by the British and also by Te Arawa. In fact, Te Arawa probably did more of the fighting, and they drove this Tairawhiti War Party all the way along the beach. This is known as Kauakauroa, or the Long Rib. And those two warships there, because these are the first generation of steam, auxiliary steam-powered warships, were able to steam along the coast and bombard the retreating Tairawhiti War Party as they went, and inflicted quite a lot of casualties on them. So this was quite a decisive battle, and it effectively secured the southern approach to Tauranga. Now, it looks like Rauru Puhiraki at Gate Pa was expecting help from these people, and now the help didn't come. So if we just go back there, not only has General Cameron arrived with more men and equipment, but one of his strongest allies has now just been defeated. So it was James Ballach who actually said, had Rauru caught a tiger by the tail, had he taken on more than he was going to be able to cope with. If we look at the Battle of the Pa itself, this is a very complicated drawing, but if you look at the top, there's three parts to it. If you look at the very top with the trenches, that's a bird's eye view. So if you look down on that, you can see there was a long ditch that ran right across the peninsula. And this ditch was probably put there to stop cattle wandering from the mission land into the Maori-owned land. And so that became the basis of this earthworks that was built. There may have been a fence, we're not sure, but there was a gate. So there was some sort of a culvert somewhere, and there was a cart track that went up to the highest point and over this ditch. And so when the British soldiers were looking up through their telescopes, this became the Pa by the gate. This was Gate Pa, and that's how it got its name. And there's a lot of conjecture about that little pa out to the side, whether it was built just the night before, as one person has suggested, the only woman in the battle, Hini Tikiri Karamu, whose story is that it was built the night before, because it wasn't tikanga for her group that arrived the day before to fight with the local people. But the fact that it's got a fence around it indicates to me that I think it was part of an integrated position there. If you look at the second bit, this part through there, you can see that the little part sits on a shoulder. And I think Rauru Puhiraki would wanted to have put some troops out onto that shoulder, or some sort of fortification out there, to make sure that the British couldn't get up onto that and then attack his pa from there. So I think that's probably what that little pa was doing out there, because the land drops away behind it quite quickly. But perhaps one of the most remarkable things about this pa was it was virtually subterranean. You can see the men in the trenches, so they sheltered. Some people will say that over 200 men sheltered underground in this pa. I don't believe that is true. I don't think it could have coped with that. But certainly a lot of them sheltered underground because they knew that they would undergo an artillery bombardment, and then there would be the inevitable infantry assault, and they would need to be able to come out from their shelter and take up their positions in the rifle pits at the front. There's virtually no wood. They did do night forays down into the mission station to get wood for some of the fortifications, but there was no real forest in Tauranga. And so whether or not it would have eventually had a palisade around it, we don't know. This is the British soldiers, the 68th Regiment, the day before the battle. Some people say the morning of, I don't think that would be right. General Cameron is the guy leaning against the cartwheel there of a howitzer. You can see a guy sitting on a Coehorn mortar, and just to his right, you can see the mortar bombs and some Armstrong artillery shells. They probably look like maybe 6 pounders or something like that. So this photo has been colorized. So there's the original is not anywhere as good as this, but it's a black and white photo. So this is what the British soldiers looked like. They were campaigning in blue uniforms by this stage. So these are the men of the 68th, or the Durham Light Infantry, and there are links to the New Zealand Infantry Regiment from then. So this was a period where Great Britain was using the latest military technology. This is the Industrial Revolution. This is the wars of the machine age. And one of the, not only was the Armstrong artillery and the steam-powered warships, but the musket as well. This musket here is a rifled musket. It's firing a new mini ball that was so successful or so lethal in the American Civil War, and it's got a percussion cap. This thing could fire very accurately 300 yards. In some ways, I think its performance is possibly as good as modern weapons. And the soldiers, of course, were taught to fight in small packets with that very long bayonet, and they drilled constantly, and they were very effective in close quarter fighting. The other thing that they had here was the largest assemblance of artillery of any of the battles in the New Zealand Wars. There were some 40-pounders, and guns of that size were only used at Merrimere. They were too heavy to take further up the Waikato and up the Waipa River. But here, guns like this, a 110-pounder from HMS Esk, could be dragged by bullocks 2 kilometres from the shore and onto a gun position. You can see it's on a naval carriage. This gun was thought to be the trump card, but it actually didn't prove, I don't think, to be particularly effective in the end. Because it was so heavy, it weighed about 4 tons, they couldn't pull it up onto the hill. There's a little low hill where the hospital is in Tauranga. They couldn't get it up there, and so it had to remain down on a cart track. And so you can see that it's actually below the elevation of the park. So when it fired its 110-pound shells, they skipped off the front of the par, and people are still finding bits of them about 2 miles out the back. So it made a lot of noise, but it probably wasn't all that effective. I think it's also got a bent muzzle if you look at that. Thank you. But this is the latest technology. These guns had only been, the first of them arrived in Taranaki, smaller ones, but this is pretty devastating. So the night before the battle, these are the dispositions. You can see the trench running across the peninsula. You can see the big par and the smaller one. And those letters, RA, Royal Artillery, NB is the naval battery. So there was quite an array of guns. And you can see the cart track that went up and through the position, which is where the gate would have been. During the early evening, General Cameron did a feint attack against this side of the par, and there was it was described as a huge pyrotechnic display, and the Maori warriors rushed across to have a look, and the sentries came in to have a look as well. And while that was going on, the 68th Regiment, the Durham Light Infantry, waded through the swamp on the left-hand side, your left-hand side, and took up positions at the back. So our full infantry battalion, about 700 men, took up positions as a blocking force at the back. And you can see, you might be able to see some of the places where it shows where they were. So the warriors inside the par were virtually, they were surrounded. And it looked as if this one was in the bag as far as the soldiers were concerned. In fact, the 68th Regiment could hear the chiefs making stirring speeches and calling on their men to be brave as they lay in the wet fern in the rain that night. The next morning, the artillery bombardment started at about 7:30. Inside the pa, Māori were saying their prayers. They had traditional tohunga who were doing their traditional prayers, and they had priests who were doing the Christian prayers, and their attitude was, well, we're just covering all the bases, we're comfortable with that. So the artillery assault, the bombardment started, and it went until about 2 o'clock. If I just go back here, you can see just on there. At about lunchtime, they realised that they could put a 6-pound Armstrong across the swamp and on a high piece of ground there, and that was able to rake down the trench line and actually dislodge people from the small park. There was no activity seen inside the park, so no one knew what had happened, and you couldn't see into it because it was higher than the vantage point that the British commanders were at. But General Cameron assumed that he had done enough damage that the place, that people had been killed, or that at least they'd been sort of bombed into some kind of submission. The assault went in at 4 o'clock, and the assault was really quite strange. It seems that Cameron wanted to share the glory between the Navy and the Army. And so the assault column was 4 men wide, 2 Navy, 2 Army, and 75 men deep. So you had a 300 strong column that snaked up out of the dead ground in front of the small par and went into the big one on a 45 degree angle. And the officers were on the outside, and they would have been very obvious. And it's quite clear that the officers were targeted by Maori snipers as they came out of their pits, because a lot of the officers were shot down at the entrance to the park, including the two senior, the senior naval officer in the assault and the senior British commander. The 43rd Regiment lost more officers than any regiment did in the Crimean War. As they went in the gap, or what was supposedly a breach into the par, they were followed up by another 300 as the reserve. And they closed up too quickly. So basically what you've got is 600 men forcing themselves into a narrow entrance, into an area of ground smaller than half a rugby field that has been dug for the last 2 to 3 weeks, that has been bombed in the rain all morning, and has got 230 men coming up out of the trenches trying to kill you. And so it was just a frantic melee. At one point, about 60 of the Maori were forced out the back, and the 68th had closed up at the back and was firing at them, so there may have been friendly fire coming back into the park. But the story goes that someone shouted, "Look out, they're coming in their thousands," as the 60 were forced back into the park. And the British broke and ran, which is very unusual because they normally have a very high breaking point. But they literally broke and ran back down out of the park. There are stories of men standing there saying, "Don't run, 43rd, don't run." But they did run. And the 43rd was named the Scarlet Runners for a period of time. And they blamed the Navy, and the Navy blamed them, and everybody tried to blame each other. But it was a defeat. And the Maori warriors were able to drive them out. But Cameron still had this place surrounded. So the 68th came up at the back, put a cordon on. He put a row of skirmishers across the front. And the local stories talk about a fog coming down. And this fog disguised the withdrawal of the locals, of the Maori. And they were able to leave and break through the cordon of the 68th, carrying a lot of their dead and wounded with them. So when the troops came up in the morning, and they were worried because they were scared that their men might have been mutilated or tortured during the night, as had happened in the Taranaki, they were relieved to find that some of the men were okay. Colonel Booth, the commander of the 43rd, was still alive. He'd been shot through the throat, and he was able to say that a Maori woman who spoke English had given him water. And they were pleased to see that the soldiers appeared to have been looked after. But the par was abandoned, The casualties that morning, Archdeacon Brown buried 19 Māori just near the pā, but perhaps up to 32 were killed in total. British, 31 killed and 80 wounded. So a large proportion of the assault force became casualties, and there were two Victoria Crosses. In this case, both for rescuing people from the battlefield. This is in the Mission Cemetery in Tauranga, and it shows Rauri Puhiraki calling on Te Ngāre Tauratau to bring water to Colonel Booth, who was dying. And this is one of the good things about the battle when you do a lot of talking about it, is at least there's a little thing there that is a little bit of humanity in otherwise a pretty desperate situation. There's a lot of stories around this that I haven't got time to go into today. The next battle took place 7 weeks later at Tauranga, and I live just at the back of Tauranga. And this is a pretty much an unknown battle in New Zealand, but it was a very significant battle with a high death toll. So after this, the Battle of Gate Pā, the British moved onto the site and built a redoubt. And the Māori had taken such significant casualties that they weren't really able to mount another force. So it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. About 1,200 soldiers were left in Tauranga, General Cameron went away to Whanganui and Napier because there were things brewing there as well. So Colonel Greer was left in command, and he had about 1,200 men at those three locations there, so they were still spread out. Now, there must have been a lot of men after the Waikato War, there must have been a lot of warriors, a lot of war parties who were in the area wandering around looking at how they could attack the British, how they could sort of carry on this war. But the Waikato situation had come to an end. But I think there were perhaps up to 1,000 warriors in the area from the east coast, from Waikato, and also from up around the Thames area. So the force that is fielded at Tauranga only includes about 100 from Tauranga and about 400 from the east coast, and even a hapu of Te Arawa that wasn't in line with the rest of them. And a battle plan was hatched at Tauranga, which was similar to the one at Gate Pā. They would build a strong position, they would encourage the Colonel Greer to come out and attack. And while he was attacking, with this large number of warriors that they had now, they would attack Gate Pā, and they would also attack Te Papa, the militaries. But General Cameron and the others realised that the mistake that they had made at Gate Pā was they had allowed the Māori to build a strong position. They'd given them the 3 weeks, if you like. So his orders to Colonel Greer were to patrol, to mount patrols every day, and as soon as they saw another pā being built, to go and attack it straight away. There was quite a lot of information coming from Māori living near Camp Te Papa, who seemed to be friendly to the British and were giving intelligence that they knew what was going on. Now, I've put the date there. I was looking at this last night and I realised that date should be the 20th of June, not the 20th of April, so I'm sorry about that. But on the 20th of June, about 500 warriors moved on to the Tauranga site in the as dusk was falling. And the plan was to have built a strong enough pā by the morning so that they would be able to withstand any assault if it was put in on them. They came with some prefabricated fencing, and of course they would have had shovels and things, and they worked pretty quickly. But by morning, Colonel Greer, they were seen by a cavalry patrol who observed them coming from up a river and then coming across onto the position. And the cavalry patrol, a four-man patrol, went back and said what they had seen. And Colonel Greer was confident enough that this was what he had been hearing. This is what was going to happen. And so he set off at about 8 o'clock on the morning of the 21st of June. And he was determined to conduct a quick attack and deal to this before the warriors had had a chance to actually build a decent position. So at Tauranga there were 500 defenders, and you can see that straight row of rifle pits there, and then there's the ground around there is very steep. So it's a little bit like Gate Par, it's a little bit like Merimeri, and it's a little bit like Rangiriri. Maori tended to want to fortify a position across a narrow neck of land with steep land that dropped away on the sides. And that's what they had done here. There were also other groups that were converging. So Greer turned up at about 10:30, marched out through Gate Par, got to here about 10:30, saw the par being constructed and sent for another 200 and just over 200 troops from Camp Te Papa and another field gun. You can see the field gun up on the hill there. It's only a 6-pounder, but it put suppressing fire down on the men in the rifle pits, and the skirmishers there fired at them. And there wouldn't have been enough protection for the men in the rifle pits because they were only down a couple of feet. So about 300 of them went over into the dead ground at the back. And Greer showed tremendous control in this battle. He sort of dictated what was happening. I'll talk about that in a little bit more in a second. Now, we've never really known whether that straight row of rifle pits was actually accurate or not, because other reports have said that it was curved. But this is a magnetic survey that was done only a few years ago, and the green square, or the little green rectangles there, show that those are the rifle pits that would be, well, like little two-man, four-man pits that were being built. And this is pretty conclusive evidence of what the par looked like. And the purple bit underneath it was where dirt had been thrown up behind, and it was going to be a sort of an embankment. Now, about 4 or 5 years ago, a water main was put down this. This is Pines Par Road. A water main was put down it to supply water to a new subdivision that was going in, and they had the archaeologists there, and they were fully expecting to see bodies because, as I'll tell you in a minute, people were buried in those pits. But no bodies were actually found, so the water main must have gone between a couple of pits, because for sure they are there. Here's another image, and it shows where those pits are again, and it shows iron. So those bright, really pink things on the battlefield there will be some of the exploded shells and so on in that area, and you can see a dotted line that shows probably where the pits went across. Now, this is an awful painting, but there's very little known about this battle, but I do like this one because it gives a bit of an idea. So you can see the 6-pound gun this time, as opposed to Gate Par, it's up high. The battlefield is flat and it's narrow. The British and Colonel Greer would have had a very clear idea. He would have been able to see the whole battlefield. You can see the British soldiers in the skirmishing line. You can see reserves there, and in the distance you can see where the trenches were. By about 12:30, the extra troops had arrived from Camp Te Papa, and Greer was ready to launch the assault. There was a group of about 500 coming across the hills, yelling out and calling out encouragement to the defenders in the trenches, and it looked like they were going to try and join in the battle. So Greer was trying to balance out a lot of things. He knew they were coming. He was waiting for his reserve force to arrive, and his two commanders, his two majors who were in command of the 43rd and the 68th detachments, were shouting at him to unleash the men because they couldn't hold them any longer, and the men were shouting that they wanted to assault. And finally Greer gave the command to charge, and they probably charged over about 80 metres. It would have been very short. Maori were in their pits discharging their weapons like this. They would have only been able to fire off one shot or two if it was a shotgun, and then it just became they just stood and bravely withstood the bayonet charge. I read somewhere that only about 2% of troops will actually withstand and withstand against a bayonet charge. Well, they did here. But because the British were able to hit them on a very wide front, as opposed to snaking into Gate Bar, and over a short distance, they literally wiped the Maori defenders off this position, and about 68 were killed in and around the back of these pits almost instantly. This is a bit fanciful, this picture, but it's... And then the infantry pursued the ones who tried to escape down through the valleys, and a lot more were killed down there. And then the cavalry was able to chase for up to 7 miles, and more were killed. So, before I go on to that. Now, Colonel Greer was aware of low tide in the Tauranga Harbour, and he was expecting, if the rumours were true, that there would be a simultaneous attack on Te Papa. He was expecting that the warriors would come across the tidal flats and attack the camp. He'd deployed the Navy into the camp to protect it, but he immediately returned with a large proportion of his force back to Camp Te Papa. It was back by 2:30, and the stories are that in actual fact there was a group that was on their way there. But they would have had to have assembled quickly because they would have heard the firing and would have had to take their chances. Casualties, approximately 130 killed. So this is almost on the scale of Arauco. The next morning, Archdeacon Brown buried 108 warriors in those trenches that they had dug the day before. About 15 were taken to medical treatment down in the mission station, but a lot of them died. So I estimate around about 130 were killed. British took quite heavy casualties as well, as you can see, and there were two more Victoria Crosses. So four Victoria Crosses in this little campaign. Now, I looked around for a photograph to put with this slide, and I decided on this one. These people are from the Ngāi Waho Hapu, and they subsequently lost most of their land, which was confiscated. The gentleman here, some of you will recognise my friend Buddy Makari. Buddy and I have written about these battles together. And the picture is of a guy called Parauni Koikoi, Parauni Brown, named after the missionary Koikoi, who was one of the leaders who was killed in this battle. In July, there was a surrender or a peacemaking. I don't know quite how we would decide it, but the tribes, Governor Gray came down. They decided that they would not fight anymore. Rubbishy old weapons were handed in, the good ones were kept, and peace was made. Now, under the new legislation, we call it the Native Settlements Act, Governor Gray was able to confiscate land of tribes that had been in open rebellion. And originally 250,000 acres of land was going to be confiscated, but because of the chivalry, because of the conduct, well, this is Gray's story at Gate Par, in the end only 50,000 acres was taken. So this is Gate Par. That, I don't know if you can see, but that little peninsula there, that's the peninsula that the mission station was on. That's where modern day Tauranga is. And where it goes from orange to pink is where where Gate Par was. That's on the border. So that pink area was what was eventually confiscated, which is the area that Ngāi Tamariwa Waho Hapu lived in. And then there were the yellow part are compulsory purchases that were done by the government at a very cheap price later on. Wrong button. And a series of redoubts were built to make sure that Māori who were now driven out of their land would not be able to come back. Now, I've just got a couple of minutes to talk about some of the commemorations. I'm part of a Pukehina Hina Charitable Trust, which has done a lot of work commemorating these battles. This is in the 150th commemoration of the battle at Gate Par, And a lot of money was spent on these po and on a new flagstaff, a little bit like the one at Waitangi, and other things in this area. And the whole city really got involved, and it was an incredible community experience. There were commemorations that lasted for nearly a month. You had chamber quartets playing in the local Whaaranui. And it was a real mixture of cultures. And I have to credit Buddy Mackay for a lot of that. I'm a member of this church at Gate Pa, and that sits on the battle site, and we do a lot of work around reconciliation. We have a thing called the 60 Bells service on the 29th of April each year at 4 o'clock, which is when the troops marched up the hill and attacked the Pa. And it's a bit like an Anzac service, but there's no recriminations. We just remember the 60-odd men from both sides who died. We ring the bell 60 times. We have prayers. And then we have a good old feed afterwards and all tell stories. Māori, Pākehā, local dignitaries. And there's also another thing, the Anglican apology. Soon after this battle, the government wanted the mission land. It wanted it for the new town of Tauranga. And it put tremendous pressure on the missionaries, Archdeacon Brown and the Church Mission Society. And eventually they caved in and gave the land. Now, the land had originally been purchased for the purpose of the development of Christianity and for the welfare of Māori, for the development of Māori. And so it was really a breach of trust by just giving the land to the government without consulting the original Māori owners. And so the Anglican Church about 5-6 years ago did an apology, quite a significant ceremony, apologised for not consulting the original owners of the land, for alienating it from them, and has gone into partnership on various projects with the local trust that represents two or three of the hapū that own the land. The final thing I want to mention is this, and this is I'm a trustee for this. It's a bit of a dream, but this, if it comes to pass, it'll be phenomenal. It's on the Bowling Green site, just beside the Battle of Gate Pa. So it's actually on the site of the battle. We are proposing to build a New Zealand Wars Museum. It'll be the story of Gate Pa and Te Runga, but it'll also be the whole of the New Zealand Wars. We're probably looking at about a $40 million project, an opening date of 2026, but I don't think we're going to hit that. But the City Council is behind us. We're at the planning stage. A lot of work has been done already. The land has been secured. And this could become quite a significant facility, I hope, in the future. And that'll do.
We'll have one of those buildings here. Have any of you got any questions at all of Cliff about the presentation or about the history? Now's the time.
Hey, don't you ask me.
this is a stage question.
I just noted that the soldiers took up their position initially in the Church Missionary Society land. So did they have permission to do that? Or did they just do it? What was the impact then? Because you also said many of the Māori were Christians. So yeah. How did they view the military occupation of, say, church land? And what did that do to you?
Yeah. So one of the things that, one of the fallouts from this whole process, that missionaries estimated that by the 1860s, perhaps up to half of Māori had embraced Christianity to some extent. But the missionaries were caught in a really difficult situation, and there had been a threat that if the soldiers ever came to Tauranga, the mission buildings would be burned. So one of the first objectives of that group that arrived was to secure the mission buildings. But then they compromised the role of the missionary, because the missionary has been there for the Māori for 20 or 30 years, and now his kinfolk arrive, take over, so where do his allegiances lie? And this was one of the constant themes that each individual missionary had to deal with. But the way it ended up is that Māori basically walked away from the established Christian religions. And you had the development of things like Paumarawi, Ringatū, And in fact, the Mormons moved into one of the marae and established a mission there. And there are actually very few Maori who are Anglican in Tauranga, because it really destroyed their faith. One of the sayings was, you taught us to look to heaven and you stole the land from under our feet. So there was a disillusionment with the role of the missionaries.
Yeah, it's a bit of history that we don't often hear about. You hear more about Dave Parr than any of the others. In fact, if you have a look throughout some of those other areas that Cliff covered, it does put a lot of more of an interesting portrayal of it. So thanks very much, Cliff. Other than that, any other points or any other questions that anybody's got? Otherwise, would you please put your hands together again and